This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This Radio EcoShock show contains disturbing possibilities. It may not be suitable for small children or anyone already prone to fear or depression. We may expect global warming or the next financial crash, but a very different disaster is also possible. It's brewing, it's becoming more likely, and it's questionable whether the nation or even this civilization could survive it. There will be not much of a warning except for what you're about to hear from Dr. Peter Pry. Dr. Pry's resume goes back to the Cold War days of containing the Soviet Union. For 10 years in the Central Intelligence Agency, he studied and reported on Soviet and Russian nuclear intentions. And that included a weapon as devastating, maybe more devastating, than an atomic bomb arriving in a major city. It's called electromagnetic pulse, or EMP. Dr. Pry has advised Congress in many roles, including, quote, the commission to assess the threat to the United States from electromagnetic pulse EMP attack. Currently, he is the executive director of a congressional advisory body called the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He's also the director of the Nuclear Strategy Forum. Peter Pry, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have looked forward to our conversation. For almost a decade, I've been warning Radio EcoShock listeners to beware of this less-known danger. What is an EMP?
Well, an electromagnetic pulse can be created by the sun or by the high-altitude detonation of a nuclear weapon or by non-nuclear weapons, although they would have they would be less dangerous. They would have a shorter radius. And basically, it's a super energetic radio wave. Imagine a radio wave that has so much energy in it that when it is received by personal computers or automobiles or anything electronic, including extra high voltage transformers that are designed to carry hundreds of thousands of volts. Imagine an electronic wave that is powerful enough to melt these. And EHV transformers have been melted by natural EMP from the sun in geomagnetic storms. In 1989, in the Hydro-Quebec storm, for example, there was a middling geomagnetic storm, not a super geomagnetic storm, but a relatively normal one compared to the kinds of storms that are generally created. And this one melted a 750,000 volt extra high voltage transformer, melted the coils in the Seabrook, nuclear reactor located in New Jersey. It wasn't the Seabrook nuclear reactor.
And who discovered this phenomenon and when?
Well, we've known for many years about natural geomagnetic storms. An astronomer named Carrington became aware of this in 1859. That's the most powerful geomagnetic storm on record. We called it the geomagnetic superstorm. It was early in the electronic age. Electronics were in their infancy. Basically, there were just telegraph systems. And the colonial powers had deployed telegraphs, built telegraph stations in Africa and India and China. They had just laid the transatlantic cable in 1859. And the EMP from the sun, from this geomagnetic superstorm, was so powerful that it caused telegraph stations to fail all over the world. Telegraph keys operated on their own with no human operator because there was so much current. Some telegraph keys melted, and telegraph stations actually burned down. There were forest fires all over the world from the telegraph lines bursting into flame in forests. And the transatlantic cable, which had just been laid, the pulse was powerful enough to reach down miles deep into the Atlantic Ocean, and it burned out the cable, which had to be replaced. Now, we've more or less forgotten. For many years, the Carrington event, as it is called, was forgotten, and the electric power industry has regarded geomagnetic storms, the kinds of small and moderate geomagnetic storms that we normally see on a normal basis, as the routine kind of a threat that we face, and it was not on their radar screens that someday we might encounter another Carrington event, which would be a worldwide phenomena again. And if it happened today, it would have catastrophic consequences and put billions of lives at risk because we cannot survive, modern societies cannot survive, without electronic systems, without electric grids and transportation, communications, food and water that are made possible by the electric grid and by electricity. Nor can less developed third world countries survive without us anymore. They depend on food and medicine coming in from the outside by these societies. That was the discovery of the natural EMP threat, which was rediscovered by the Congressional EMP Commission that met in 2001 to 2008. And the chairman of that commission, Dr. William Graham, I was in the room when he was pacing back and forth in front of a blackboard. We had been commissioned by Congress to look at the man-made EMP threat, the nuclear EMP threat to our electric grids. And I remember Dr. Graham, who had, in a previous existence, been the director of NASA, said, you know, you don't need a nuclear weapon to make an EMP threat. Mother Nature can do it. And he talked about the Carrington event and said we should actually include this in our report because in some respects the natural EMP threat is even worse than the nuclear one. A single nuclear weapon might be able to threaten electronics in a continent or in a large country, but a natural EMP event like recurrence of the Carrington would be a worldwide phenomenon. The EMP would be everywhere and putting all societies at risk simultaneously. So even though we had known about this super geomagnetic superstorm that had happened in 1859, it didn't really come onto the radar screen for people to think about this as a threat to modern society until the EMP Commission did its work. And then subsequently the National Academy of Sciences and everyone else agreed with us and produced their own studies on it. Now this is a long answer to your question about when did we discover EMP. In terms of the nuclear EMP, you know, we did not become aware of this until in the United States until 1962 with the Starfish Prime nuclear test that happened over Johnston Island. Nobody knew what would happen when we detonated the bomb above the atmosphere at high altitude, that is above an altitude of 30 kilometers. But it knocked out the lights in Hawaii and caused other electronic systems, radio systems, underwater communications cables to fail. And the Department of Defense didn't know why. And Dr. Graham, who was then a young defense scientist, his first job with the Department of Defense, you know, was to go to the Hawaiian Islands and Johnston Island and try to figure out what happened. So he was present at the discovery of the nuclear EMP threat. I was only in first grade when he was doing that. So he more or less rediscovered both the natural EMP threat and the nuclear EMP threat.
Dr. Pry, what sort of energy are we talking about? Could we see or feel the electromagnetic energy? Is it like lightning?
It is like a super lightning. You wouldn't see or feel it. Well, think of it as an electromagnetic pulse from a nuclear weapon basically comes at you in three waves that we describe as E1, E2, and E3. E1 is the electromagnetic shock wave. This is the most powerful of the waves, and it comes out because the gamma rays knock electrons off of oxygen atoms high in the atmosphere, and they spin around the Earth's lines of geomagnetic force and induce this EMP. By the way, to try to give you another explanation, a simpler explanation that people might grasp, you know, in physics 101, you know, a current is generated in a wire by a moving magnetic field, okay? A current is generated in a wire by a moving magnetic field. So if you have a manual lawnmower, a lawnmower that requires you to pull on a cord, what you're doing is you're spinning a magneto, which is a cluster of magnets, and it's causing a moving magnetic field inside your lawnmower. And the magneto is surrounded by a coil of wires. And that moving magnetic field generates a current in the wires, and that's why you get a spark in your spark plug, and that's what makes the lawnmower run. Now, the Earth is a giant magnet. It's got a north and a south pole, and it's surrounded by a powerful magnetic field that protects us from cosmic radiation and powerful particles that are thrown out constantly by the sun. We wouldn't be able to survive if we weren't surrounded by this benign magnetic field. Now, when a coronal mass ejection, that is a chunk, that is basically the sun, will every now and then, out of sunspots, it will throw a piece of itself out into space. And every now and then, one of these chunks, they call them a coronal mass ejection, is basically a great big blob of ionized particles that are traveling millions of miles an hour. And they will slam into the Earth. And the magnetosphere saves us from being fried to death. The magnetosphere will get deformed when it gets impacted by this blob of ionized plasma called the coronal mass ejection. And it causes the magnetic fields to move around. And that movement of the magnetic fields induces currents and wires on the surface of the Earth and in airplanes flying above the Earth. So that's basically another way of understanding what an EMP is. You know, it's basically the electricity that's generated by a moving magnetic field. Now, this first field that we talk about, the E1 EMP that comes off a nuclear weapon, is an extremely powerful field, you know, because the movement is happening in nanoseconds, okay? It's a very, that's how fast it is. That's how fast the electrons move around, rotate around the Earth's lines of geomagnetic force. So consequently, you get a tremendously powerful field. But its immediate effects are harmless to human. It'll pass right through your body like a radio wave, and you won't even know it's there. And you won't even know the nuclear weapon went off, frankly. You know, this is happening in outer space. At least, it has to be above an altitude of at least 30 kilometers. An altitude of 300 to 400 kilometers over the center of the United States is what most people think would be likely for an EMP nuclear attack on the U.S., 300 to 400 kilometers up. That is so high, you know, that on a cloudy day, you wouldn't see the explosion. You wouldn't hear any noise because it's happening in the vacuum of space. There'd be no blast effects on the ground, no radioactivity on the ground. The only thing that would happen would be the EMP, which people wouldn't even know about until they went to try to start their cars or talk on a telephone or use some other electronics, which would be destroyed. Unfortunately, people flying through the air in airplanes would know about it because depending upon the power of the pulse, at least some of them would crash. And if we're talking about a very powerful pulse, like from a super EMP weapon, most or all of the airplanes would crash. That's 500,000 people who are usually airborne at any given moment, flying in over 1,000 airliners over the United States. And, you know, a super EMP weapon detonated at that altitude would probably bring them all down. But they're not being killed directly by the EMP. They're being killed by the failure of the electronics and of the engines on the airliner. That, of course, is cold comfort to them. In the long run, EMP is actually deadlier, far deadlier, than if you took that same nuclear weapon and detonated it in a city. If you did that, if you did a ground burst, say, in a city like Washington, D.C., with a 10-kiloton weapon, you might kill 200,000 people through blast and thermal and radioactive fallout effects. But if that same weapon caused a nationwide blackout that lasted 1 year, a protracted blackout lasting 1 year, so that you had no communications, industry and business did not work, the transportation system didn't work, the food and water systems, the infrastructures that supply us with food and water no longer work. I mean, the water would be cut off immediately because it takes enormous amounts of electricity to move the water around. And we only have enough food in the whole country to feed 310 million people for 30 days. And that would begin to spoil almost immediately the refrigeration systems and air conditioning systems that keep the food wholesome. I've only got a 3-day power supply. And when that 3 days is up, the food will begin to spoil. So if you've got a blackout that lasts a year, at best, at the very best, we would have a month to feed our people. And then what happens? How do you keep 320 million people alive with no food and no water until you can bring the grid back? But you probably couldn't bring the grid back. The EMP Commission calculates that we could lose 90% of our population within a year. You know, that's hundreds of millions of people. So consequently, that same bomb, if it was used for an EMP attack in this way, instead of using it in the city, you know, it could basically end our civilization. And that would be, from the perspective of terrorists or rogue states that wanted to do us harm, a much more cost-effective use of a nuclear weapon, as it were. It would give you by far the biggest bang for the buck in terms of bringing our country to its knees and killing off our people. Now, there's two other kinds of waves, but that gets into the technical, and we don't have the time to make this whole thing a dissertation on the various waveforms that come out of a nuclear weapon. I think the audience gets the idea at this point about what an EMP is and what it can do.
Well, yes. I mean, I'm in oh-my-God territory. We're talking about the lights go out, the Internet fails, we can't find out anything except from our neighbors, the systems break down, the population doesn't even know an EMP attack happened or what happened. It sounds like an instant trip back to medieval times. Is that really possible? Are we talking about a possibility?
Oh, yes. In fact, it's an inevitability if you're talking about the natural EMP threat. We will see another Carrington event for sure. It's just a question of when. And we could see something more powerful than Carrington. 1859 was not that long ago. You know, we had just introduced magnetometers in 1859 and started paying attention to geomagnetic storms. You know, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. It's just strange credulity to think that in 1859 we happened to see the most powerful geomagnetic superstorm that could possibly happen. That seems highly unlikely, far more likely that Carrington was an example of the kind of thing that could happen. And we have seen, in fact, on sun-like stars in other solar systems, coronal mass ejections that would produce superstorms far more powerful than Carrington. Even if we hadn't seen that, common sense would just tell you that this is probably not the most powerful storm the sun can produce. And NASA estimates that the likelihood of the recurrence of a Carrington event is 12% per decade. Because we haven't seen another Carrington-sized solar superstorm since 1859, and since we think it's likely that these will recur every century or so, you know, NASA estimates 12% per decade, which virtually guarantees that within our lifetimes or that of our grandchildren, you know, we will see this civilization-ending phenomena. But it doesn't have to be a civilization-ending phenomena. I mean, ultimately, in the end of the day, you know, the EMP Commission was a good news story because we do know how to protect against this threat. It's not that hard to do and not that expensive technologically. It is hard to do in terms of the politics of EMP, which is why we're still not protected. The politics of EMP are keeping us all vulnerable. In terms of the nuclear EMP threat, we could be on thin ice right now. You know, as you and I are speaking, we're in the middle of a military exercise that's held every year called Full Eagle 2017. In South Korea, where the United States and the South Korean forces mobilize thousands of troops and are going to fly B-52 bombers to South Korea to try to deter and punish Kim Jong-un, the dictator of North Korea, for making nuclear threats to attack the United States and to attack our allies. He gets particularly excited during these Full Eagle exercises because the exercises, frankly, are aimed at North Korea. Their goal is to practice a disarming strike against North Korea's nuclear assets, just in case he were to decide to launch them, and also a decapitation strike to take out the leadership of North Korea, meaning the dear leader himself, Kim Jong-un. Now, this guy is a psychopath, and he has nuclear weapons. He has ballistic missiles, and he has two satellites currently orbiting over the United States called the KMS-3 and the KMS-4. The first of these was launched and passed over the United States during the first nuclear crisis. Well, up to that point, it was the worst ever nuclear crisis we had with North Korea. On April 16, 2013, it passed right over Washington, D.C., and periodically it'll pass within every day. It'll pass right over the center of the United States at the optimum altitude, if there were a warhead on that satellite, to put an EMP field over all 48 contiguous United States, plus most of Canada and Mexico, you know, which would have catastrophic consequences. And we don't know what's on that satellite. Is that satellite really just for scientific research purposes? It does not transmit any data, and it belongs to the military. Fact is, North Korea does not have anything like NASA. Its so-called its space program is subordinate to the military. And last year, during another nuclear crisis in the aftermath of their fourth illegal nuclear test, they orbited the KMS-4. So now we've got two satellites. And Kim just threatened to launch a third satellite over the United States. So, I mean, I'm in my long-winded way trying to answer your question about how real is this threat? How likely might it be? It's as possible as those satellites. You know, we could be in imminent threat of a nuclear EMP attack right now. You know, if things go wrong in this, if there's miscalculation, you know, on the part of the North Koreans or on the part of us, and if North Korea has put a nuclear weapon on those satellites, if that's what those satellites are about, if they're intended for a surprise nuclear EMP attack in some kind of a supreme crisis, you know, we are a push button away from having an EMP catastrophe on this country. And Kim isn't the only one who plans EMP attacks in the like. China or in Russia, and Iran openly write about using nuclear EMP attacks as a decisive way of defeating the United States in a war.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, and my guest is Dr. Peter Pry. He's an American expert on electromagnetic pulse weapons, which could fry our electric grid. Check out Peter Pry's many books to find out more. Well, one of my worries, Peter, is what happens after an EMP attack on any major nuclear power. The military, I'm told, has already hardened key systems to survive such an attack. Wouldn't the response be a massive launch of conventional nuclear weapons against the suspected attacker?
Well, knowing who attacked you is a big part of the problem when it comes to EMP. Let's take those North Korean satellites again. You know, they're on this peculiar south polar trajectory, and there's a reason for that. You know, the North Koreans appear to have been copying what the Russians did during the Cold War. The Russians had a secret weapon called the fractional orbital bombardment system. And the idea here was to disguise a nuclear warhead as a satellite, and if they wanted to make a nuclear attack on the United States, they would launch it to the south. So it would not go over the North Pole. It would appear to be flying away from the United States. And it would go over Antarctica and then come up at us from the south. We have no ballistic missile early warning radars facing south, and we have no interceptors to intercept anything coming up from the south at us. We didn't in the Cold War, and we don't today. So we're basically blind and defenseless from that direction. You know, the first we would know is there'd suddenly be an EMP field and everything would stop working. You know, there's hundreds of satellites in those low Earth orbit altitudes. Other actors who could do it. It could be the Chinese, could be the Russians, might not have been a satellite at all. It could be a terrorist group that launches a nuclear EMP attack off of a freighter, you know, which is another way of keeping your fingerprints off of it. And the EMP from the satellite, it'll take out the satellite ground stations. It'll take out satellites themselves. It takes out command and control systems. If it's a super EMP weapon, and this was in congressional testimony, so I can say it, it generates field strengths that are far greater than the hardening programs we've implemented against in our forces. So it could even paralyze the nuclear forces themselves. So basically, you could escape retaliation by blinding your adversary, you know, by taking away the national technical means that are necessary to ascertain who did this attack, because in order for deterrence to work, you have to know against whom to retaliate. And it could take away your means of retaliation by paralyzing the forces themselves. So doing it anonymously by satellite is one way. Another way is by launching off a freighter. But you don't even need a missile. You know, if you put a weapon in a balloon, there are high-lift balloons that can bring a warhead up above 30 kilometers. And it doesn't have to be anywhere over the continental United States. So you could launch a balloon off a freighter at sea somewhere and have the weather patterns, or rely on the weather patterns to carry it over the United States. So there's a lot of ways of doing an EMP attack anonymously so that you wouldn't even know against whom to retaliate, assuming that you're still capable of retaliating at all. And then even if you did know who attacked you, what would the president's highest priority be? I think his highest priority, I hope it would be, bending all of our national resources in the direction of trying to save the American people before we have the catastrophe we've been talking about. People end up starving to death and dying because of a lack of food and water. The state stopped the nuclear reactors from going to Fukushima, which they will do in 7 days if the electric grid goes down for 7 days. On the seventh day, they run out of emergency fuel supplies for their emergency generators, just like in Japan. You could have 100 nuclear power reactors, most of which are co-located with our population centers, going Fukushima and spreading radioactivity out everywhere. There's going to be plenty for the military and the Department of Homeland Security to do right here to try to save American lives. So a president might decide, look, we can take revenge against North Korea or Iran or whoever did this later. Right now, I've got to save the American people. There's that to consider as well.
So what can we do about this?
Well, fortunately, we've known for 50 years how to protect against EMP. The Department of Defense has been hardening. It's just we should be making even our military systems harder, because even North Korea has probably got super EMP weapons. You know, these weapons, we were told in 2004 by a couple of Russia's top EMP experts, they were generals who teach at the Russian General Staff Academy, but they demarched us. And this was highly unusual. I mean, I've dealt professionally with weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons, and threats, and dealt with Russia all my professional life. And the Russians, they have often proliferated, done it on purpose. They've often proliferated technology to our enemies for Cold War purposes. But this was the only time I know of that they admitted that they came to us and said that there had been technology transfer from Russia to North Korea, the design for their super EMP weapon. This was in 2004. They claimed that they didn't do it on purpose. They claimed it was accidental, that because of brain drain, you know, there was an economic crisis in Russia, and top Russian nuclear weapon designers and missile designers had gone to work for the North Koreans, and that the North Koreans were also hiring Chinese and Pakistani nuclear and missile experts to help them. And these guys said that, unfortunately, that it's not hard to build a super EMP weapon, and that they predicted that in a couple of years, this was 2004, mind you, in a couple of years, North Korea would be in a position to test such a weapon. And they just wanted us to know so that we could be on our guard. And in 2006, right on the money, North Korea did its first nuclear test. Most of the world declared this to be a failure because the yield was so low. It was only in the range of 1 to 3 kilotons. But that's exactly the yield that you would expect from a super EMP weapon, because the weapon is designed not to create a big explosion, but to convert its energy into gamma rays, which is what creates the EMP effect. So North Korea has probably got the super. We need to be further hardening even our military forces to deal with higher level EMPs. Our civilian critical infrastructures, we can use the same technologies that are proven that we've used for the military, except scale them up so they can deal with the super EMP phenomena. You know, Faraday cages, surge arresters, blocking devices. The listeners in their homes have probably got some of these technologies, you know, right in their homes. For example, if you, on your personal computer, if you look at the plug, you know, the plug that goes into the wall is not normal sized for personal computers. It's a little larger than a normal plug. And that's because there's a surge arrester inside that. And the surge arrester is designed to protect your computer in case there's a lightning strike on the power lines and the lightning follows the lines into your computer. That surge arrester will protect your computer from lightning. Now, that won't work against a nuclear EMP attack, but it's the same principle. And if we scaled up the technology, you know, we can protect the extra high voltage transformers and the SCADA systems and all the other complex technology that we need to survive from this phenomenon. Another example of something in your house that would actually work against nuclear EMP too is your microwave oven. You know, the reason people don't get injured by their microwave ovens is because they're designed as Faraday cages to contain the microwaves inside and not let the microwaves leak outside to injure your eyes or cause other injury. And microwave ovens are so well designed, they would even work as a good Faraday cage against a nuclear EMP. For example, if you had survivalists don't discard their old microwave ovens. They actually keep them, and they'll keep cell phones and other electronics that they would like to have in the aftermath of an EMP event around, because a microwave oven is a very good Faraday cage.
And you've mentioned transformers a couple of times. You know, when Fukushima did blow up in Japan in 2011, I looked more into the fragility of the grid and found out there are no standard transformers for these big transformers that the utility companies use. They each have to be ordered uniquely, and it could take years to replace them. There's only two factories in the whole of Asia that even make them. That seems like a dangerous bottleneck. Can't we standardize our utility system so that we could come back and have some spare parts and be ready?
Well, it would make more sense to harden the transformers that we've got, precisely because replacing these big extra high voltage transformers is a nearly impossible task to do on an emergency basis. You know, they're bigger than a house. They weigh hundreds of tons. As you noted, the worldwide ability, the entire world, not just those who make them for export, but the entire world only produces 180 extra high voltage transformers every year. That's the annual global production of EHV transformers. The United States has 2,000 EHV transformers in its electric grid. So if we were to lose half of those, say 1,000 EHV transformers, and suppose the world really bent its back and upped its global production from 180 to 200, well, that means it would take, if the entire world focused on just recovering the United States, it would take 5 years, you know, to build enough transformers to replace all of the half that had been destroyed. A super EMP weapon might destroy more than that. And other countries might want those EHV transformers to recover themselves if we're talking about a natural EMP event of some sort, which is going to be a worldwide phenomenon. 5 years. And as I noted earlier, you know, we're looking at losing 90% of our population in 1 year. So coming up with a better transformer is probably not the answer, because it takes so long to manufacture them, and then to move them into place. It takes typically 18 months just to build one of these transformers, and then it takes a long time to move them into place. Bridges have to be reinforced. Highways have to be strengthened and widened. There's only 2 railway cars in the whole United States that are designed that are capable of carrying an EHV transformer so that you can get it somewhere near where it has to go. The Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Energy did jointly cooperate on what they call a reliable replacement transformer program. And they've come up with a prototype transformer that can replace some of the smaller, less powerful EHV transformers, they claim. And they've done experiments with this, where instead of taking months, it only takes weeks to move one of these things into place. And I'm not against the program. I'm for anything that is going to introduce more reliability into the electric grid. And I do think that the utility should have more spare transformers, you know, and we ought to plan an exercise for trying to rapidly replace them. But on the end of the day, if you're talking about the kinds of threats we're talking about, the scale of loss, even if you're talking about scores of transformers, it's going to be almost impossible to do that quickly enough.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Peter Pry. We're talking about EMP, electromagnetic pulse weapons, or it could come from the sun.
So the highest priority should be on protecting those transformers so that they don't get destroyed in the first place. And unfortunately, we haven't been doing that. And this is where we come back to the politics of EMP. You know, the electric power industry doesn't want to do it. And that's the essential problem. You know, the electric power industry is the last critical infrastructure that, in effect, regulates itself. It exists in a 19th century regulatory environment. You know, there is no government department or agency that can order the 3,000 utilities in this country to protect the electric grid. We've tried to pass bills in Congress, and they have fought against them and successfully defeated them for the most part. Except last year, we finally did pass a bill called the SHIELD Act, you know, that should, in theory, give the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission the authorities to order the electric power industry to protect its transformers. The problem is that we discovered that the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is, political scientists call it regulatory capture, when the department or agency that's supposed to be the oversight body and is supposed to regulate a particular industry gets captured by its lobbyists. The commissioners, if you look at who most people have never even heard of U.S. FERC, and yet their lives are as dependent now upon the decisions made by U.S. FERC, maybe even more so than by the decisions the Department of Defense makes, precisely because of this EMP threat. But the guys who get appointed as FERC commissioners tend to be lobbyists and lawyers who work for the electric power industry. And so they are captured by the electric power industry, and they know who their master is. So even with the legal authorities at their disposal, they are not likely to act on those legal authorities and harden the grid. We passed another bill called the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act. And this requires the Department of Homeland Security to create a new national planning scenario that's focused on EMP. This is a giant step forward toward improving our security, because basically it harnesses all of the emergency planners and first responders, the millions of policemen, and National Guardsmen, and hospital workers, and other people who are engaged in first responder activities and emergency planning, and says, in addition to being prepared for mass pandemics or a nuclear terrorist bomb that goes off in a city, or cyber warfare or chemical or biological warfare, you guys need to know about this EMP threat and be prepared for that as well. So there is forward movement. There is progress being made. Unfortunately, because of the way Congress works, you know, the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act, it falls short of being able, you know, you couldn't put it in the bill to say, and electric power industry, thou shalt protect the grid by installing Faraday cages and transformers. But it does bring enormous power to bear. It does bring enormous pressure to bear on them to do the right thing, to protect their grid. And hopefully some of them will pay attention, but I doubt it. You know, what's going to have to happen is I think we need new institutional arrangements. FERC and NERC have to be replaced as the institutions that safeguard the grid. And while they may be kept around for their normal business, which is determining what electric rates should be and protecting the grid from falling tree branches and squirrels, that seems to be about the level of their competency. When it comes to these more exotic threats like cyber attacks and EMP and physical sabotage, all of which are in the enemy game plan, you know, we need a more robust institution that has a national security orientation.
Yeah, the Grid Protection Agency, perhaps, something like that. Is it naive, Peter, to think that solar power on people's homes could provide a more safely distributed energy environment?
Not at all. I'm for anything that decentralizes the way we get energy. The fundamental vulnerability is because we've evolved this big grid, which is a natural antenna for receiving EMP. And it's also a natural set of dominoes for, like, cyber attacks or physical sabotage, so that if you use cyber or sabotage, if you can knock down one domino somewhere, knock off just a couple of those EHV transformers, their load gets dumped onto neighboring transformers. And so you get a cascading failure that ends up rippling through the whole system. And that's all because it's a big grid. If we islanded the grid, I mean, the ideal island is your own home. The new technology I'd like to see is less a new transformer. You know, I would like to see someone innovate a technology that enables people to have a power source in their homes that would come along with the home when you buy that home, you know? So that basically it's like buying a cell phone that has a battery inside of it already. You know, that would be the ultimate decentralized grid, and it would make our society much more resilient against these threats that we're talking about. And not only that, it would also change the politics of EMP and even the politics of our society in a very profound way. To get on my soapbox a little bit, and what I'm about to say is my own personal views and doesn't represent the views of the EMP Commission. The EMP Commission isn't interested in working a social revolution in this country. It's interested in protecting the electric grid. If you think about the kind of country that the founders had in mind when we were a republic, you know, what Jefferson had in mind was a nation of small farmers and shopkeepers, and he believed that the kind of American people, the kind of American character that we had at that time, was naturally disposed toward democracies, toward the democratic process. Jefferson actually hated democracy, but that gets into a different. He liked liberty, the idea of individual liberty. The people who were jealous of their freedom and independence, suspicious of government, and wanted power in their own hands to affect their own fates and to be able to have the power to shape their own destinies. And we, if you look at the way our society was organized, the way the infrastructures were organized, as it were, it was highly decentralized. You know, people did. They chopped their own wood. They made their own fires. They heated their own houses. They didn't rely on something like NERC and FERC or a federal government to provide them with the things they needed to survive. You know, we've become, you know, the tendency toward collectivism is reflected in our technology and may even stem in some part, in large part, from the kind of technological base that we have, which is a collectivist type base. But if we could come up, and there are technologies in the pipeline that within a generation, you know, might enable people to power their own homes so that you wouldn't have to be beholden or dependent on NERC and FERC and all of this alphabet soup of what goes on at the federal level, it would be a way of kind of returning us to that pioneer that existed at the time of the founding of the Republic, that individual American who wasn't dependent on outside forces but had a self-sufficiency. And it could foster the kind of rugged individualism that made this country great and free.
I think there's a movement developing along, even in the left along that way, in self-reliance and self-reliant communities and growing your own food and keeping track of your own water supplies. So there are some people moving in that direction. I think we're going to have to leave it there. Is there any final message that you'd like to leave with our listeners, Peter Fry?
Yes. Don't wait for Washington. Become part of the solution. Reach out to your state legislature, your governor. Individual states have hardened their own grids. Maine, Virginia, Florida, Texas is trying to do it, is starting to move in that direction. They're not waiting for Washington. And you can harden the grid at the level of a community. So I would encourage people to get involved. And my book, Blackout Wars, is available at Amazon.com. And it's basically a handbook that explains how the average citizen can take his destiny in his own hands. In the state of Maine, we got the grid hardened up there. We started with one determined person. Just one determined person can make the difference. And it took 6 months to get a bill through the Maine state legislature to protect the Maine electric grid. Whereas that hasn't happened in Washington. It took 8 years for us to pass the legislation I've been talking about today at the level of Washington. So be like that American that Thomas Jefferson had in mind, a rugged individualist, you know, who is going to seize his own destiny and make it happen in your state.
And I think that's true in Britain or Europe and Canada and Australia. The same basic principle applies. Dr. Peter Pry has written some excellent books on EMP weapons. I read his 2013 book, Electric Armageddon. His latest is Blackout Wars, State Initiatives to Achieve Preparedness Against an Electromagnetic Pulse, EMP Catastrophe. And you can find a lot more at the website www.thenoafoundations.com. And you'll find helpful follow-up links, including a video or two, in my own weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Peter Pry, I really appreciate your giving your time to our Radio EcoShock listeners.
Thank you so much. The NOAA Foundation is not my foundation. My website is www.emptaskforce.org.
We'll look for that as well, and I'll put that link in my blog. Thank you so much. I'm Alex Smith, reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Scientists agree that more extreme weather events will hit most of the Earth as the climate shifts. Studies of Americans after Hurricanes Katrina and Sandy showed increased and continuing mental health problems, including post-traumatic stress disorder. Is it possible each hit of climate change could leave the general population less able to deal with the next? What about the impacts of extreme weather in developing countries, where studies are seldom done? Now we know more, thanks to research published in the journal BMC Public Health. Three authors combed through the records in South America and Asia following extreme weather events. Let's see what they found. Our guest is Elizabeth Ratai, and she's the lead author. Elizabeth grew up in Saxony, Germany, where she obtained a Master of Public Health at the University of Dresden. She did the research on the lasting impacts of severe weather while working in Dresden in the Center for Evidence-Based Healthcare. Now employed by a large German development agency, Elizabeth is an advisor at the Department of Education in the autonomous region in Muslim Mindanao in the Philippines. From the Philippines, Elizabeth Ratai, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, Alex. Nice to meet you. Thank you very much for calling.
Well, I'm glad we connected. Now, what led you and your co-authors, of course, to investigate the specific impacts of extreme weather, and you looked outside the usually studied places like Europe, America, or Japan? Why?
Well, actually, all three of us have lived and worked in developing countries before we actually met in Dresden. So Susan, before she became a psychologist, she worked in India. Catherine was in Northeast Africa, and I spent a couple of years in Southeast Asia and also in regions of South and West Africa. So, and I remember during the time we met, there was a flood of the Elbe River in Dresden, to whom of you might this place be familiar, and a lot of people were displaced and they had to clear their houses. And I think all three of us remember that those kind of events are very different for people in the places where we actually lived before. And, yeah, I think that was one trigger why we came up with a question like this. And, of course, we're all interested in this kind of topic.
Yes, well, Dresden would have all the resources and people to look after people after they'd gone through the event, and you wouldn't find that elsewhere, and that's what we're going to talk about. So what sort of extreme weather did you look into?
Well, we looked for floods, droughts, storms, and heat waves, and we did this systematic search on that.
But I thought I saw in the paper that you decided not to include heat waves.
Oh, we did actually include them in our search, but we didn't find any. So we didn't identify any droughts and any heat waves. And, yeah, I don't know, we came up with different excuses or different reasons why this might have happened. For example, I think both of those disasters are, like, creeping, so you don't really identify when they start and when they end. So this actually makes it very difficult to start collecting data and do research on these things.
But I have to say, that doesn't mean there weren't any heat waves, because I remember some very extreme heat waves in India and Pakistan, for example.
Oh, definitely there were. Yeah, correct.
So where are some of the countries that you included in your study?
Well, we identified studies from India, from Vietnam, China, Nicaragua, and yeah, a couple of studies in those countries, and a single study in Mexico, a single study from Honduras, and from Bangladesh as well.
Well, that's going to give you good representation. How many individuals would you say were included in this research?
Well, in our systematic review, we in the end included 17 studies, and this comprises more than 70,000 people. Yeah, the individual studies go from 125 people in one study up to 25,000 people in another study. So the range is really, like, quite broad.
And your paper divides the impacts into primary outcomes and secondary outcomes. Why is that?
Yeah, we choose the secondary or the primary outcomes to be post-traumatic stress disorder and injuries. And for the secondary outcomes, it's anxiety and depressive disorders. To divide like this is usually done in systematic reviews in order to prioritize the outcomes and to put out the relevance for the actual research question.
Okay, now the two primary problems that might come up right after a violent storm or flood, beyond the deaths that may occur, of course, are direct injury, which you studied, and post-traumatic stress disorder, known as PTSD. First of all, why did you include injury in your study?
Well, we are actually interested in healthcare, in healthcare infrastructure in general. So that's why I decided not to look only into mental health and mental health related structures, but also like for a physical disease. And additionally, like, if we are in developing countries, mental health illnesses are very often neglected and not very well researched at all. So to make sure we actually find something, that's why we choose to go for those both options.
And there is a myth out there that goes something like this. PTSD is just a first world problem. Peasants living close to the land, they're very hardy. They bounce right back. They don't have time for mental problems. True or false?
Oh, false. I absolutely disagree. Well, first of all, PTSD is not a mental problem. It's a disease that's internationally recognized and classified. And, well, I mean, we are all equal. If I break a leg, that could happen to you, to same to you as well, Alex, or to some people in Africa or in Bangladesh. So there is no difference.
But you couldn't exactly go around interviewing, you know, tens of thousands of people in hard-to-get-to places. Elizabeth Ratai, how did you and your team do this research?
We identified or we defined our research question. And for this research question, we decided on eligibility criteria, what we are actually looking for, what kind of people, what kind of disasters, what kind of studies. So we can actually pool them together. Then we identified the most relevant databases that we were going to look into. And then we started a search. So we searched six databases. We hand-searched two additional journals. We also hand-searched the reference lists of those studies we actually included. Yeah, then we ended up with like 927 studies. We screened all their titles and abstracts and then kicked out the studies that were not relevant. Ended up with 38 studies, and we really looked into detail in each of these 38 studies, and again, we kicked out those studies that did not fit with our eligibility criteria, and that's why 17 studies remained, and we really looked very closely into those 17 studies.
And that helps us develop the bigger picture of what is happening in many places of the world. Well, let's say a violent storm wipes out a city in the Philippines or a flood destroys a shanty town in East Asia. What happens to the children who survive?
Well, children are most of all more vulnerable, especially physically, if you just look at them. So in case they lose their parents, often they will be given to relatives, and especially relatives are less sensitive to take care or to observe their behavior, so they would not easily detect mental diseases. Well, if they end up with a relative, they're actually lucky. Most of them end up on the street being street children. Currently, I live here in the Philippines, and street children is a very, very big thing. Most of the coastal cities of all, you have so many, like in Cebu and Davao, Manila, you have millions of street children. And many of them actually, I think, do have a background of tsunamis, of typhoons coming, of landslides destroying their villages. That's, I think, a main cause of their story.
Well, aside from the geological causes, which are just part of the Philippines, I think we could also say that these may be the first signs of climate refugees. These are kids who have been displaced by extreme storms, extreme weather. Maybe that's how it will begin to appear. Although I have to say there were kids in 1992 in Rio de Janeiro when I was there, a lot of street kids. So it's not an entirely new phenomenon, but it's growing. But then again, Elizabeth, there's this urban myth that kids get over traumas quickly. Do kids get PTSD, for example?
Oh, well, actually, Alex, in the PTSD was researched in kids first. And I think it started in 1980, and they started researching on PTSD, and they exclusively looked into children in the beginning, and later on only in adults, also in adults. So they do get this disease as well, to answer your question. Well, I also hear that you're asking whether they are experiencing less or more PTSD, and I think the literature is not quite clear about that. Some studies would state that children suffer less from PTSD, which would mean they can also get this disease, and some other studies also come up saying they're not easily affected, so meaning they don't get it so easily. But, yeah, I think there's a big gap in research, or more research needed, especially in research in developing countries.
That's interesting. All right. And I looked into weather-driven PTSD stories in America, and there were a lot of people saying they get nervous every time the weather forecast plays on TV or certain sounds set them off, like the wind blowing something around the yard or just looking up at clouds and feeling nervous. What is your picture of what happens to extreme weather survivors?
Well, if you're pointing at a difference between the developing world and the Western world, I think there might not be so much of a difference between the survivors. They have the same symptoms. They have flashbacks. They will avoid triggering situations and thoughts. A lot of them have sleeping disorders because they are afraid of having those nightmares again. So this is, I think, the same all over the world. PTSD develops basically in two ways. It fades away with the time for some people, so the symptoms really get less. And for other people, it gets chronic. And it might also develop into different diseases like anxiety disorders and depressions, suicide for some of them. So that's really broad if it's not treated well. And that brings me to the next point. Well, the way how it's dealt with is very different in developing countries than from the Western world. I think that makes the big difference.
Well, what is the difference? What happens in developing countries that's different than in the Western world?
If you look at their healthcare systems, they're often very basic, and they're not so much sensitive, and most of the place not so much sensitive. There's not so much funding for treating mental diseases. They're not as obvious as a broken leg that I referred to earlier, although it's a disease just like that.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest public expert, Elizabeth Ratai. And we're talking about the long-lasting impacts on the humans who experience extreme weather events. Well, let's move on, Elizabeth, to the secondary outcomes you tracked. What does that mean?
Our secondary outcomes were anxiety disorders and depressive disorders. We decided to add this one to our main research question as secondary outcomes, and we actually only found 6 studies that looked into that, and those 6 studies actually also just added to their original research. So those studies were actually looking into PTSD, and they added anxiety disorders, depressive disorders to that, because it's not so easy to find data on that, and it's not so easy to identify. That's why we added it like this.
Okay. And do you think that people lose some of their faith in the goodness of life if they've been through a typhoon, a flood, or a similar event?
I'm not sure, and part of me really disagrees, because what I've experienced living in developing countries for quite a bit now, that the less people have, the more satisfied they are, if they are not like in desperate hunger or in pain. But a lot of them have very strong faith in God or whatever religion they belong to. And even if they are hit by a disaster, they would often manage to maintain their optimism or their resources to manage. For example, they would lose their house, and then they would be happy, say, oh, but I found my son, and I'm happy that I still have my relatives. That's what I often experienced. And, I mean, on the other hand, they're just so very used to it, because they really, like, they experience disaster like this more often, and they are, well, the harm they experience with the disaster is much more than, if you remember the Elbe River, just having a little bit more water when people have their basements underwater. But here people lose their whole house. That's the difference.
I understand. Did you find an increase in what could be called clinical depression?
Well, clinical depression would be the major depressive disorder. And I looked it back up in this study, and there's actually 2 of the studies we included specifically looked for that. And they found an increase. One study is talking about a typhoon that happened in Vietnam, and they found a 5.9% increase. And the other one was done in India after a cyclone hit the country, and they found a 17.6% increase, which is pretty interesting. I mean, there is an increase at all. But what we also found, like, if we do a systematic review, we try to pool those studies. We can also pool their data if certain requirements are given. But for this case, it was unfortunately not possible, because one study was, or I think for this one study, they got the data 1/2 year after disaster had happened. The other study only got the data after 2 years that the disaster struck the country. So that makes it so much different. Some of them are only exclusively looking into students, the other one looking at the whole entire population. So that makes it very difficult to merge data, which would be more helpful to have more stronger evidence-based data.
Do we know, Elizabeth, if the lingering stress after extreme weather affects local economies or even the national economy?
I would definitely agree. However, I think it depends on the impact, how strong the impact was of the disaster. I mean, if there is like a flood, the local markets really are affected. People lose their houses. They would need to start rebuild. They would need to start buying new construction material. On the other hand, there is not so much available on the market. It makes the price go up. People are unemployed if the local infrastructure is destroyed. So it definitely affects the local markets. And it also goes up to national level if the disaster is on bigger scale. So I think it's actually, sadly, a downward spiral. So if there's no measures in place and if there's no international aid coming in.
Yes. Elizabeth, why is it difficult to research what happens in Africa?
Oh, that's a very big question. I think there's one main reason is that there's so much poverty. So there's hardly any funds from those countries themselves to do research, to properly do data assessment, to put into place monitoring evaluation systems. Big issue also for organizations going into those countries encouraging research would be the problems of peace and disorder, that there's war, there's areas where you cannot go, you would need to have local communities that you're working with. And this really takes a lot of time. And if you're asking for funding, you need to have like a timeline and beginning and end. But this is two systems come together here that are very, very difficult to combine, or you really have to do like splits between the demand of the status of doing research and on the other hand, what's actually possible, doable in the country.
Well, let's say that we have a situation where there's many deaths in a developing country from some extreme event. And in the West, we briefly see the news reports with displaced people and suffering. Maybe there's a fundraising drive, and then it's over for us. Elizabeth, what can be done to overcome this short-term response and memory, to really plan for what will surely happen again and again?
I do have to go a step back here. There speaks the health worker in me. I think prevention is better than cure, and we should always start preventing first. So I see a strong responsibility on our side of those living in, well, not for me at the moment because I'm in the Philippines, but living in the Western world. And most of what they are experiencing is due to our behavior, our lifestyle. So I could just encourage each one of us to buy local, use trains, fly less, all those sort of things would already help in the first place. Yeah, and then secondary and tertiary prevention would be strengthen the M&E system of the countries themselves, helping them with data gathering, yeah, and those sort of things.
And is part of that building up primary health care in these developing countries to respond quickly when disaster arrives, or as you say, to put in public health measures that might really help ahead of time?
Well, it's both. I mean, since disasters are already happening, you need to prevent them from coming back. And there is already a lot of learning, which you should definitely include. And then you should try to build systems for response. I think most of those countries have very good infrastructure already in place. So we should actually strengthen their own systems. Yeah, they're very creative often. They have their nurses, mobile clinics. And the place where I live, my street doesn't even have a name, so people don't really have addresses or houses, but they have two, three, four mobile phones. So they are actually very good equipped with, well, that would encourage us to use new technology. They know how to use apps and all those kind of data, so that's a way we could also just work and reach them with a healthcare system.
Through the phone. Is there anything else you would like to add or talk about?
Thank you for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to share.
Well, we've been discussing an article published in September 2016 in the journal BMC Public Health. The title is Extreme Weather Events in Developing Countries and Related Injuries and Mental Health Disorders, a Systematic Review. And that's an open access article, so anyone can read it. And you can find links to this article and my guest in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. We've been talking with the lead author, Elizabeth Rotai. She did this research at the Dresden Center for Evidence-Based Healthcare. Elizabeth is now employed by a large German development agency whose name I cannot actually pronounce. Elizabeth, please tell us the name of that in German.
That would be the Deutsche Gesellschaft für internationale Zusammenarbeit. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad you did it, not me. Thank you so much for helping us understand the longer-term effects of these extreme weather events. We are out of time. Thank you for listening, and join me again next week.